This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
This morning, I introduced Bill C-2, the Strong Borders Act. The bill updates existing laws to bolster our response to national and economic security threats while enhancing the integrity and fairness of our immigration system. Among some of the key changes are new powers for border officers to examine goods destined for export to prevent the transport of illegal goods such as stolen vehicles. Law enforcement and intelligence agencies will also have some new tools to stop the flow of fentanyl and its precursors.
Lawful access is back. Bill C-2, the government's border bill, includes a comprehensive set of lawful access rules, including a new information demand power that would result in warrantless disclosure of information about subscribers, a new international production order, and requirements for providers to assist law enforcement in working with their networks. The issue was largely dormant for more than a decade after the Supreme Court's Spencer decision, but the government apparently saw an opportunity to leverage the concern about the border to bring it back, claiming, as you just heard, that it may assist in dealing with fentanyl. There will no doubt be multiple episodes devoted to this bill in the coming months. To get us started, I'm joined this week by Robert Diab, a law professor at Thompson Rivers University and the co-author of a recent text on search and seizure. He's also written several pieces on Bill C-2, and he joins me to discuss the historical context of lawful access and the key provisions in the bill. Robert, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. So you're back and lawful access is back. It's one of our oldest policy issues, it feels like. It goes back now at least a couple of decades, a little more than that. And it certainly felt for a time that the Supreme Court in the Spencer case had largely ended the debate. I mean, we just didn't see any new proposals coming out of government for a time. But here we have Bill C-2, ostensibly about the border. And towards the very end of that legislation, the government brings back lawful access provisions that I think are bound to spark some pretty intense debate about how we strike the balance between ensuring law enforcement have the tools they need, but that Canadian privacy rights are respected. You're the co-author of a recent book on search and seizure law in Canada. You've done a couple of great posts on the lawful access provisions. So really the perfect person to come on board and talk about it. You know, I obviously want to get into those provisions, but before we do that, I have a lot of conversations about it already. And each time feel that there's a bit of a need to provide some history and context so people have an understanding of being able to situate how these lawful access provisions came about. So can you describe a little bit what is lawful access and a little bit about some of the longstanding policy debates that have surrounded it?
Sure, Michael. So this is really a kind of an initiative that extends at least as far back as the mid-90s, you know, with the birth of the web. And the phrase captures a wide ambit of measures that the state agents, mainly the police, are seeking. It could be anything from authorization in law for immediate access to IP addresses, subscriber information, or lesser forms of data like tracking or transmission data, metadata, et cetera, or it could even be building in a backdoor to encryption. So, you know, the more invasive the measure, the more controversial. And it's been debated around the world. Democracies really everywhere have had debates about this. In Canada, there have been waves of efforts to pass legislation. In your great recent post about the new bill, you note a bill in 2010 that went as far as to mandate disclosure of subscriber ID, IP addresses, device IPs without a warrant. Maybe one of the most memorable, notorious moments in this debate is in 2012 when Conservative, the public safety minister at the time, Vic Taves, said to an opposition member in Parliament, "You could either stand with us or stand with the child pornographers." The Conservatives went back and forth on lawful access and abandoned it near the end of their term. And There were further discussions in Parliament in 2017. A parliamentary committee recommended not going down that route, and so there was the longstanding debate about it, which never died. Also, maybe worth mentioning just historically is in 2004, Parliament followed a worldwide trend of bringing about adding to the toolbox in law what are called production orders, special warrants for police to obtain forms of data. And, early on at that point, it seemed obvious that those orders were necessary for police to demand the content of a message or a chat. But it was less clear whether they were necessary for things like an IP address, subscriber information, forms of metadata, and if so, on what standard. So while that was there, and there was some debate about, whether it was constitutional and so on, police continued to want more easier access to these forms of information without a warrant.
Okay, you're right. It has been ongoing. You certainly hit on a few of the highlights. Ironically enough, that your stand with us, or your stand with the child pornographies, was directed at Francis Scarlapeggia, who is now the Speaker of the House. So
yes, that was a neat detail.
Yeah, it's kind of neat to see how he's certainly been around quite a long time. He'll maybe help explain why he was elected now Speaker. And so it's been around for certainly many politicians who have now by now come and gone. One consistent thing, though, has been law enforcement seeking these kinds of powers. And while there's been some of the political pushback that you just highlighted, it was a Supreme Court decision in 2014, the Spencer case, that seems to have had a real impact, at least over the last decade or so, of putting at least some of this on ice, so to speak. Can you talk a bit about what the Supreme Court had to say in Spencer, specifically around this issue of access to subscriber information?
Yeah, it was a really important case for digital privacy, our privacy rights online. It might help just to lend a tiny bit of context to this. So I'm sure most of your listeners are well aware that Section 8 of our Charter guarantees everyone a right to be secure against unreasonable search or seizure. And the courts define a search as anything done by a state agent for an investigative purpose, anything done for an investigative purpose that interferes with a reasonable expectation of privacy over a place or a thing. And so if that is the case, then a search will be reasonable if it's authorized by law and if the law itself is reasonable. And so in Spencer, the facts basically were that police had asked Shaw for the subscriber ID attaching to an IP address they had. And so the Supreme Court had to answer two questions. Was the subscriber information private? Because if so, then asking for it constituted a search. And did police have the authority to search it? And so the court said, yes, a subscriber ID is private, so asking for it is a search. And no, police did not have authority in that case. It was private because possession of a the name attaching to an account or to an IP address connects a person to a fairly extensive search history that can be very private, very invasive. So for that reason, subscriber information is private. Now, so then, then the question was, did Crown have authority did police have authority? The Crown in that case sought to rely on a provision in private sector privacy legislation, and the court said, no, that's not authority for a search in a criminal investigation. So that's it. That was really the end of Spencer. What was unclear at the end of the case is what would constitute a reasonable law authorizing a search of subscriber ID. Now, presumptively in criminal law, a law authorizing a search will be reasonable if it's pursuant to a warrant on probable grounds. So the presumption here is that subscriber ID requires probable grounds. But not all privacy experts in Canada agree on that. So you can rebut the presumption, you can depart from it, you can have a search carried out on something lesser than a warrant on probable grounds, and it can still be a reasonable law if it strikes the right balance between the interests of law enforcement and the personal privacy issue, interest at issue. And so some people take the view that maybe reasonable suspicion would strike the right balance here, a warrant on reasonable suspicion. So it's unclear. It's an open question after Spencer. Now in the wake of Spencer, as it happens, in June of that year, Parliament amended the production order framework in the code to create a general production order on probable grounds to seek, you know, a wide range of information, and then more specific forms of production order for limited kinds of information like metadata, transmission data, tracking data, etc., on reasonable suspicion. So in the wake of Spencer and those amendments in 2014, police started to use the general probable grounds production order warrant, and obviously they've not been happy with that. They would prefer a less onerous tool.
Okay, and we'll come back to the standards that we see in Bill C-2 in just a moment. Two more pieces of background, though, to set the stage. That was a really good rendition of what we saw take place in Spencer. Supreme Court has the opportunity to revisit at least some of these kinds of considerations in terms of the privacy import of data that may be linked to a subscriber by, in the bike of its case, and IP addresses. Can you quickly flag what we saw took place there? There was a podcast episode last year that focused on it, but a quick summary would be great.
Yeah, no, ever so briefly, the Supreme Court in Bykowitz had an opportunity to go a step further and ask the question, do we have a privacy interest in an IP address itself, in the bare numbers? So as, again, listeners are well aware, I'm sure, we are always leaving a digital trail of IP addresses when we visit websites, whenever we travel or communicate on the web. And so in Bykowitz, police had information that led them to a platform, a service provider, and they said, can you give us an IP address that was used within a certain time frame? And so the court had to address the question, was that a search? It was a search if it was private. And the answer, so the court was closely divided. It was a 5-4 decision. And the majority said it's private for more or less the same reasons that a subscriber information is private in Spencer, essentially because with that number, you can readily link a person to an extensive search history that is very private. But for the dissent, it was not sufficiently private to engage constitutional protections because it required a further step on the part of the police. Yes, it had the potential to link a person to very private information, but unless police took that extra step, it wasn't, and therefore it was kind of a bit remote. And I think that's worth keeping in mind because I'm going to suggest that some of the new powers might be analyzed in a manner closer in nature to Bykowitz than to Spencer.
Okay, that's interesting. We'll come to that in just a sec. Before we do unpack a little bit the different provisions and powers that we do find in Bill C-2 with respect to lawful access, can you just highlight what is Bill C-2 and to the extent to which you want to speculate, what is lawful access doing in it?
Well, so it's the Strong Borders Act, and it's ostensibly a response to pressure from the Trump administration to beef up the borders, beef up enforcement, give customs, immigration, various other agencies involved more powers. But in the midst of it are buried a series of search provisions that have nothing to do with the border, that can be used in ways completely unrelated to traffic in and out of the country. And so it's very curious that it's here, and it does raise, you know, big questions about why is it being added to this bill.
Okay. All right, with all of that out of the way, that it's more of a windup than is typically needed. But as I say, this is one of these issues that's been percolating for so long. It's important, I think, to understand the context. There are several different new powers and provisions that I think are really relevant in C2. why don't we start first with the new information demand, which really kind of extends that discussion about what can law enforcement access or demand from providers. So what is this new information demand? When would it apply, and what information is covered?
So this is going to be a new provision added to the warrant provisions in the code. So that's where it will be situated, that allows police on reasonable suspicion alone, so without a warrant, to make a demand for information from anyone who provides a service to the public. That's the language in the section, a service to the public for various kinds of information. They can ask whether the provider has provided services to a certain user, a phone number or other identifier, like maybe an IP address. What kind, so that's a yes or no question. Have you, so they're not asking, it's not a power to get the IP address. Have, yes or no, did you provide service to this number? But they can demand what kind of services were provided, what device identifiers were used, when and where did they provide the service? If it's in Canada, tell us the province and the municipality. If it's outside the country, tell us the country and the city. They can also ask a provider for information about other parties, like other platforms or websites, etc., from which the user may have received further service, if they happen to know that. So that's okay. What it says.
That's quite a lot of information. And just to be clear, that's on reasonable suspicion. So what safeguards, if any, are in place when these requests, assuming this, let's say this passes, what safeguards are in place if a provider receives one of these demands, these information demands?
Relatively few. I mean, if a provider can contest it, say that they're not in a position to, to deliver this information quickly or easily, that sort of thing. But the time frame is limited, and they can be compelled to keep it confidential. And so I imagine going to be a standard condition in every order, keep this confidential. So in short, not many oversight provisions at all.
Okay. And who gets to use this power? You mentioned police, but just how broadly defined are the various entities that might be able to make use of this power?
So certainly the, peace officers, anyone authorized under the code, but also in the CSIS Act, there's an equivalent power added there too. But one limitation there that is important is that CSIS can use it, can make these demands on no grounds at all, but they have to be conducting a national security investigation, and they cannot make the demand in relation to a citizen or a permanent resident.
Okay, so that then I guess gives rise to, you mentioned the location data, for example, in terms of where was the service used. We are presumably then oftentimes perhaps talking about this in the context of perhaps outside the country. They can make the same sort of demands if that was outside the country, although it's more of a citizen-based limitation.
Yeah, I mean, just because of the way that the power is demanded, it's anyone who provides a service to the public in Canada, and so that would presumably capture entities situated outside. Clearly this is going to be challenged as constituting a search. I mean, it raises the question, maybe one distinction worth just flagging here is that between police asking questions and police carrying out a search. So they carry out a search whenever they interfere with something over which there's a privacy interest. It's a very fine line between information and a seizure, you might say, or being told something and coming into possession of something. So I think if they demand an IP address, and an IP address is given, you've got a search. But if they say, do you have the IP address? Do you have this IP address? Has this IP address been used on your platform? Is that a search? It's going to be very fact specific, fact dependent. But obviously there will be cases where a search is carried out when police ask, did so-and-so have an account at the gambling site, Pornhub, what have you. When did they use, when did they visit? Where were they accessing it from? How did they log in? Did they use their Gmail, etc.? I think once you get into all of that, you're probably triggering a reasonable privacy interest. And if so, a search on reasonable suspicion alone, raises questions. I mean, I'm speculating that there may be a good number of judges on the Supreme Court of Canada who would see this as, raising privacy concerns, but not enough to attract constitutional protection because it's a little remote, it's a little removed. Further steps may need to be taken to get more meaningful information in hand. I could also see a number of judges saying, no, this is really not meaningfully different from the acquisition of an IP address.
Okay, so just to be clear, so we've got the Spencer and Bykovitz decisions that you just discussed. You're looking at this and saying, well, it sounds like this is potentially even a little bit further away from an IP address, and so your suspicion, so to speak, or your guess here is that the court, which was divided in Bykovitz, might well find itself divided on one of these kinds of cases and. Could fall one way, could fall the other way. It's a close call, and in some ways, it almost depends a little bit on the facts of the case. Do you get one where the privacy interests become really salient, or is it, or potentially one where judges say, well, that just feels a bit too remote for us to say that this falls on the privacy side of the ledger.
Yes, although maybe just briefly to add to that, the tendency in the last several Supreme Court of Canada cases on Section 8 in the digital privacy context reflects a willingness on the part of the court to think very broadly about the implications. So they tend not to, make the decision about whether to call something private, make it turn on, the individual facts. Although maybe one exception to that would be Farron, where, unfortunately, whether we have whether search of a cell phone incident to arrest without a warrant is reasonable. I think I'm not alone in thinking that perhaps the primitive nature of the phone at issue, like the very limited data that it was like a flip phone, like it was a pre-smartphone, even though the decision comes in the mid-aughts or the mid-2010s, it maybe that shaped their thinking. But that's exceptional. I think in the rest of the cases, the majority thinks in broad terms about what this could mean. And that, I think, works in favor of a finding that this requires more than mere suspicion.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. It is, I think, one of the reasons I think many were surprised to see this brought back is because if it at best is such a close call, one wonders why the government is choosing to move in this direction, in this way. Surely there might have been some other mechanisms to address some of law enforcement's concerns in terms of giving them the powers without, not necessarily creating a coin flip at the Supreme Court, but knowing that a challenge is guaranteed and the outcome is far from guaranteed in terms of the government's position and legislation being upheld. There are the that's the information demand. The next up is the production order. You talked about the creation of production orders almost 20 years ago. We've seen now an expansion here. What do we see with respect to a production order here? What does it permit, and how broadly can it be applied?
So picking up the thread from Spencer and the open questions left at the end of that case, the bill proposes a new dedicated production order for subscriber information itself, and does so allows for that order to be issued on reasonable suspicion. So again, that would be departing from the presumption that a criminal investigative power to be reasonable under Section 8 would require a warrant on probable grounds. But the question for the court, when this is challenged, which it will be for sure, will be whether reasonable suspicion, given the nature of subscriber information, is sufficient, whether that strikes the right balance. And again, I think it will. So I think the best argument in favor of the answer being no, no, it's not enough, it should be probable grounds, is that I have two, briefly two thoughts on that. One is the strength, the depth of the reasons for a finding that we have a privacy interest in Spencer. So, you know, those are really important passages in Canadian law on digital privacy. The court goes into some detail to elaborate on an interest not only in privacy, but anonymity online in Spencer. So it would seem to me that given the, you know, the seriousness with which the court takes those interests in that case, you know, that mitigates in favor of a finding that it should be nothing less than probable grounds. Also in Bykovitz, the majority was not answering the question, the court was not answering the question, what is a reasonable law that would authorize the search of an IP address? It was simply asking, is the demand for an IP address a search? And if so, therefore it's going to require authority. In passing near the end of the majority decision, Justice Karakatsanis refers to the availability of warrants for transmission data, production orders for transmission data. Those can be obtained on reasonable suspicion. And she sort of says in passing, look, you know, they're there. Those are great. Police can just use them, which is in a sense, you know, a sanctioning of that tool as the appropriate means of obtaining it. So if that's the case, then it would stand to reason that for more invasive information, more powerful information in terms of privacy, you would require something more. But again, that was just obiter, and all of these questions are, I think, still open to debate.
Yeah.
Briefly, the other power that's getting attracting some attention and causing some controversy is there's a new provision that will be added to the code that allows for police to seek a kind of warrant, but it's not a warrant because it's not a production order. It's a kind of permission from a court to make a request. That's the word used in the provision, of a foreign entity to, and I'm quoting, produce a document containing transmission data or subscriber information from something like, you know, Google California, or, you know, iCloud, Apple in California, that kind of thing. And the best sense I can make of this is that it's a response to criticisms of the Brecknell decision out of the Court of Appeal in 2020, where someone was seeking, well, police were seeking information from Craigslist in California, and they were seeking to have a production order apply extraterritorially. And there's been criticism of this decision along the lines of, you know, Canadian law shouldn't apply extraterritorially unless that intention is made clear in the statute. So what they've done here is they've made clear the intention that we want police doing stuff outside of Canada, but we don't want to issue orders, create orders that have binding authority on California and so on. So this is kind of a halfway measure.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, certainly some of the international dimensions of attracted a lot of interest and attention. We know that some of the larger platforms have often said, you have to come back to our essentially our home base if you want to order us to do something, and oftentimes said wanting a local order to do that. So is there enforceability here, or this is just opening the door to making these kinds of requests? And I guess what I'm really asking is, what's the likelihood that the larger platforms, who presumably this is really thinking of with this particular new order, are going to comply with simply a request, even if the request has effectively been now approved by through Canadian law?
It's a great question. I suppose it will turn largely on the policies of the various platforms. You know, maybe some will want nothing short of a real court order, but maybe others will deem this sufficient. But it may turn out to be the case that where companies insist on a court order, police in Canada will seek a Canadian production order along with a request order, you know, all at once, one-stop visit to the courthouse to do this, or by telewarrant, and then approach Apple or whatever company worldwide.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it plays out. Speaking of working with some of these larger players, the third element that that's, I think, really notable here has to do with mandated assistance to law enforcement. Can you talk a bit about that? That too is these. This too are provisions that are proposals that date back many, many years when there was a hope, especially from some of the signals intelligence community, that they would have greater assistance and access to the networks of some of the larger providers.
Yeah, this strikes me as maybe the most concerning of the new provisions, for reasons we can get into. But so there's going to be a whole new act, the Supporting Authorized Access to Information Act. So it's a whole new statute added to the bill that will be targeting what are called electronic service providers, who are defined quite broadly. So they're anyone providing an electronic service, which is anything from storage, creation, transmission of data to people in Canada, or if they happen to be situated here. So this is like really conceivably anybody from, you know, of course, people like Shaw and TELUS that give us the internet, but also all the platforms where we essentially reside for most of our time online, like Gmail, etc. So it imposes a wide set of obligations on someone that is an electronic service provider, but essentially it limits those obligations to assisting with helping test devices that they might have in house for access that enable access to what are called authorized persons, which are anybody who has lawful authority under the Criminal Code or the CSIS Act. So just those two things, not a broader ambit. So that's maybe not disturbing in itself, but the bill also allows for the creation of a subset of electronic providers who will be called core providers. And they're going to be subject to regulations that mandate, and again, it's worth quoting this, the installation of any device, equipment, or other thing that may enable an authorized person to access information. So that just sounds chilling and completely Orwellian. And so I'll just stop there as we digest that.
Yeah, no, I think I want you to keep going. I mean, that sounds like for a certain subset of providers, the vision is that law enforcement will have internal access to the network and the ability essentially to establish various kinds of surveillance capabilities within it. Now there's oversight, I assume, associated with all of that, but nevertheless, that sounds like that's where we're headed.
Yes. I mean, but there are a couple of important safeguards to take, I guess, some consolation in. One is that, you know, just as mentioned, they need either CSIS agents or police need lawful authority. They need a warrant. They need whatever it is authorizes what they're looking for. The other one is that they can't do real-time surveillance. If they do, that they would trip the case law and the criminal code provisions around interceptions or wiretaps. So they can have ready access, but if it's designed in such a way that it gives them essentially real-time access to your data as it's being produced, then that would be a wiretap. There's one other impressive, I think, clear line that's being drawn in the act, and that is that neither electronic service providers or core providers can be obliged to do anything that would create, and the language here is systematic vulnerabilities, you know, as to the security of data. So I take that to mean that what's being taken off the table here is a requirement to build backdoors to encryption. And I think that's a good thing.
Do you have a thought on, you know, who precisely they have in mind with these core providers? Are we just talking about the big players here? Do we have any sense or any indication even from the government what they have in mind specifically with core providers and why they've chosen, in a sense, to carve out certain new obligations for those providers as opposed to the broader definition around ESPs?
Well, you know, clearly the distinction being drawn in the act between ESPs and core providers is one that follows the distinction between mere assistance with testing and installing equipment that makes access much easier. And so, who would they want that power over is really one question. And I think it would seem likely that it's going to be the big ISPs, Rogers, TELUS, etc. And it would seem plausible that it's also going to be some of the big platforms, like maybe Google Canada. There'll be some requirement to install, some tools to make it easier to obtain an IP address if authorized. But this is very speculative. I mean, this is a new power. I'm not enough of a comparativist in this area to know whether there are similar frameworks around the world that the drafters of this bill have borrowed from and have some experience with. I mean, I'm looking forward to the parliamentary backgrounder on this to get a better sense. But I would think, certainly just a bit like plain reading of the Act would suggest that all such providers, the big platforms, Instagram, Gmail, iCloud, etc., all of them could be compelled if they have data centers in Canada to install equipment. But we should also mention that there are considerations in the bill or in the statute that the minister before imposing rules and regulations on them has to consider, and they could be challenged on administrative law grounds as being unreasonable or for various reasons, but so there are additional safeguards in that regard, but still it's quite concerning.
Yeah, no doubt. All of this, to wrap up, suggests that at a minimum, I like to often close when we're thinking about a new bill by talking about next steps. I mean, we talk about what we might see from a legislative perspective, but it certainly sounds that regardless of whether we're talking about the new information demand power, we're talking about some of these kind of assistance requirements, it's almost certain, it sounds like, we're seeing legal challenges on the information demand power from, say, the criminal bar. I can't imagine if there was an attempt to apply these requirements on data centers for some of the large global players, the Amazons and Googles of the world, that they would simply comply without challenging them in court either. This feels like that in some ways, even more than in some bills we've seen, this is a bill that, perhaps it gets passed in this form or gets adjusted a little bit, but this is almost stage one in some ways. And it sounds like this is the sort of stuff that may spend quite a number of years being litigated in court.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's sort of two steps to this. There's going to be the question of what form does the bill end up in? How many more safeguards are added between now and third reading but I do agree that I think every single aspect of what we talked about today will be litigated thoroughly across the country. And I think the criminal law powers we mentioned are going to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. Because they're just so extensive and will change the landscape. But maybe one point worth adding is we've only really touched, part of what's in the bill. Like, the bill has so much more we just don't have time to go into today, and so there's going to be there's enough litigation here to keep the Supreme Court of Canada busy for another decade.
Robert, thank you so much for coming on and so knowledgeably breaking down some of the history, but especially what's been included this time around in Bill C2.
Thanks so much, Michael.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.